Are you a scaling SaaS founder?
Ready to make the leap from leading a team to leading an organization? Join us each week as we refill your think tank with actionable tips and strategies from great business minds you know and those you don't know yet. This is SaaS Fuel with your host, five-time entrepreneur, SaaS founder, and globetrotting adventurer, Jeff Mains.
Welcome back to the SaaS Fuel podcast, where our approach to standing out isn't just about being different, it's about being unmistakably superior, kind of like a lighthouse in a sea of lanterns. I'm your host, Jeff Mains. I help B2B SaaS founders like you grow from traction to scale. Here, growth is more than just numbers. It's about creating a future-proof company, premium valuation, and leaders who build a business of significance while living epic, adventurous lives. You tired of bowing to competitors' pricing? I'll show you how to dominate your market and set your own rules for product and pricing with monopoly control. Now, a lot of companies, I hear it all the time, are tired of constantly competing on price in a crowded market. I think it's time to master the game and create monopoly control over your product and pricing. So imagine a scenario where your business stands tall, unshakable, amidst the chaos of competition. A world where you hold the power to dictate your own terms, package your product as you see fit, and command the price that reflects your true value. That world is within your reach, and it all starts with creating a sustainable competitive advantage and what I call monopoly control. Welcome to the realm of business dominance, where the rules are yours to write and the market is yours to conquer. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. And the threat of commoditization looms large. Companies are constantly vying for market share, ready to undercut prices and erode profit margins just at a moment's notice. Some industries, it is a race to the bottom, where quality and innovation take a back seat to copycats, price wars, and short-term gains. But you know, I say we don't play that game. Sound good? There is another way, a better way. You've probably heard of Warren Buffett talk of this idea of having a deep and wide moat around your business. It's differentiated and well-positioned in the marketplace, and that is what we want, to rise above the fray and deliver value so unique that price sensitivity is low or may completely go away entirely. That's where the power of sustainable competitive advantage and monopoly control comes into play. To achieve this level of market dominance, you need a three-pronged approach, and that is differentiate, differentiate, and differentiate. We'll break that down. But seriously, step one is to really differentiate. It's worth saying three times. Your product has to stand out from the crowd, offering a unique value proposition that can't be easily replicated. Whether it's through superior technology, unparalleled service, or a brand identity that just resonates deeply with your target audience, you must create a clear and compelling reason for your customers to choose you over the competition. Second is to build an impenetrable moat. And this is one where I think founders really get tripped up. And that is that thinking that the next big feature is the thing. Sometimes that's true, but it's pretty rare. You know, let's just say if your code was frozen in time and you couldn't build anything new, scary, right? How would you differentiate? What would make your business unique and stand out? And I love playing this game with founders. They're like, hey, that's not fair. We have to be able to build stuff. You know, the market's moving fast. You know, it is hard, yes, but it is absolutely worth it. Look at your messaging. Look at your marketing. Look at everything you say about your company, about your product. And the moat is two things. It is meaningful to your ICP, and it sets your business apart. What are those two things in your marketing that you're talking about now? And if you don't find them immediately, it's time to go to work and figure out what are those. And it's not just building the next thing. Today's guest actually has really good perspective on building something meaningful, that messaging for your ICP. Third is we want to dig a deeper, wider moat. And once you've established your unique selling proposition, it is time to fortify your position. And that means investing in intellectual property, forging strategic partnerships, which is in a couple episodes down the road, creating a network effect that makes it difficult for competitors to gain a foothold. The wider and deeper your moat, the more secure your monopoly control. And monopoly control is just one of 12 ways that we work with companies to exit at a premium valuation. It's not just by accident or lip service or something we say in our own marketing. This is how we actually do it. But the rewards of achieving sustainable competitive advantage and monopoly control are immense. Higher prices drive more revenue, which drives more margin, which can be reinvested into sales and marketing to more revenue and margin. It's a really nice domino effect, and you get this upward spiral. Creating sustainable competitive advantage and monopoly control is one key to unlocking long-term business success and a premium valuation. By differentiating your product, building an impenetrable moat, and then doubling down on that moat, you can rise above the competition and dictate your own terms in the market. So if you're ready to take your business to the next level and achieve the kind of market dominance that most companies only dream of, start implementing these strategies today, especially the one where you're thinking about your code being frozen in time. You know, how would you differentiate if you couldn't build anything new? That's a tough one, but it is worth figuring out. The path to monopoly control is waiting for you. If you like the idea of scaling up, check out my book, Small Fish, Big Pond, Building a World-Class Business That Swims Circles Around Competitors. Small Fish, Big Pond delivers powerful marketing and leadership lessons guaranteed to enhance your marketing message, wrap value around your clients, and guide their buying journey to conclude that your company is the only solution for them. It includes step-by-step frameworks and time-tested growth principles to attract ideal clients, convert them, and then transform them into your brand ambassadors. Pick up the print, ebook, or audio today, Small Fish, Big Pond, or Amazon. And remember, all book profits go to charity, always. Our founder on Tuesday was John Miller, founder of Scribewise. He is revolutionizing B2B marketing with a bold approach that champions courage over conformity. We talked about courageous marketing and unique ways to stand out in a crowd. Fits very well with today's topic. And our expert guest last week was John Sarver, innovation and technology consultant at SaaS Logic. We talked about usage-based pricing, hybrid billing systems, and pricing to win. Again, fits really well with today's topic. If you missed either of those episodes, go back and give them a listen. My guest today is Janie Smith, a celebrated corporate consultant, speaker, CEO, and best-selling author with over 30 years of experience. Janie has revolutionized business strategy through her books, Creating Competitive Advantage and Relevant Selling, which also form the backbone of her influential keynote presentations and Smart Advantages consulting framework. Her work empowers businesses to harness their unique strengths and thrive in competitive markets. Welcome someone who it will never be a commodity, Janie Smith. Hey, Janie, welcome to SaaS Fuel.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I love your work about competitive advantage. What is a competitive advantage in a company, and what is it not?
Okay, that's an excellent question. Competitive advantage is how a company differentiates itself. Warren Buffett, when asked, what's the single most important thing you look for when you invest in a company? Warren Buffett replies, without hesitation, competitive advantage. Yet when I ask business owners, business leaders in all kinds of industries, how often do you review competitive advantage in your companies? The two most common answers I get, when they're being honest, are never or once a year. I say, okay, fine, at least you do it once a year. When is that? When we do planning. Oh, good, we give it almost 20 minutes. I'm here to tell you this is a lost discipline that dramatically impacts the top line and bottom line of businesses. Warren Buffett did okay by focusing on it. And I really want to get small, medium-sized businesses focused on this. I travel all over the country and out of the country preaching this. And when they do it, when they get their arms around it, it makes a difference. So back to your question, a competitive advantage is what makes you stand out. A competitive advantage is not a cliche. We sell good quality. We sell good customer service.
Right.
That's cliches. Everybody says it. It's nonsense. A competitive advantage must be quantifiable. Value proposition is that which is relevant. You're talking to the customer about something they care about, and it's measured. So a competitive advantage-based value proposition is relevant, measured, and relative to their alternative choices. When I ask groups of business owners, what's your number one competitive advantage? I get all those nonsense answers, cliche, you know, good customer service, good people, all our people, we're expertise, we're smarter than everybody else. I go, yeah, blah, blah, blah. That's what we've coined that phrase for them. We tell them that's nonsense. A competitive advantage, and this is important, is not what you think you're good at if the customer doesn't value it. So if you want to tell your customers, we're really good at writing code fast, okay, that may be important to you internally to turn around the project, but it may not be the buying criteria for the customer. I'm making that up because I don't know what it is for each company. But we see that all the time. So competitive advantage is what the customer values that you can measure. It's not a cliche. It's ideally not stated by the competition. And most important, it must be relevant. You must be selling what they care about.
That's so important. And, you know, when we talked before, you talked about your research, and it was 90% of companies, and that was just staggering, 90% of companies don't know their customers' top buying criteria.
Yeah.
So they don't even know what's important to them to talk about.
Yeah.
Why is that disconnect so prevalent?
Because 90% of information used in organization is internally focused. And this is from Drucker, and only 10% is about the outside. That's exactly backwards. We're all internally focused. Companies have KPIs galore. They got millions of KPIs, but they don't have what we've coined the phrase CRIs, customer relevant indicators. What are those things you measure that the customer cares about? What's your turnaround time? What's your error rate? What's your redo rate? What's your downtime? What are those things that impacts the customer? So back to the number you quoted, yes, when we do double-blind market research for companies of any industry, we'll go out, double-blind means the respondent has no idea who's commissioned the research. The company doesn't get to know what customer A, B, and C said. They get projectable data, 90% of your customers value A, B, and C. So we go back to the company and we say, okay, we have your research here, and we're going to tell you what the top three buying criteria is for your industry. But company, team, what do you think came in 1, 2, and 3? I'm doing this for 25 years, over 300 companies. 90% do not know their customers' top three buying criteria. That's pretty frightening. And the next question is, okay, so here's the top three buying criteria. Let's say for a company, it might be order accuracy. Do you measure order accuracy? Nope. 85% of businesses don't measure the things the customer values most. So to me, this is so simple. Find out what they value, measure them, and make sure all of your performance, operational performance, excels in those three or four top buying criteria. And then you have a competitive advantage. So very few companies do it.
That's really, really big. And you know, when you want to have something that is a competitive advantage and quantify that, say we're 85% better in this, or we have a defect rate of 0.000001% or whatever it is, but you're saying 85% of them don't even measure what the thing is that they need to be using as their competitive advantage.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of that, when I'm talking to a group of business owners, and this is the most common attribute, on-time delivery, right? I'll say, okay, in the audience there, how many of you think on-time delivery is important of your product or service? Everybody raises their hand. Okay, now, how many of you measure it? Well, about half. Maybe it's a good group, two-thirds will raise their hand. Okay, of those who say you measure it, how many of you use it, update it monthly, and use it in marketing and sales? All the hands go down. So, I mean, you know, we had a machine repair company, and the number one attribute was first-time fix. How many of you measure it? Yeah. A third of the group measured it. A third of the business. Okay, how many of you use it? None. They saw it as an internal KPI, not an external customer relevant indicator. You have to look at your KPIs or create CRIs. What are the things the customer wants to wants from you. If you're writing software for me, what's the result? I mean, what my favorite one is a company we worked with a long time ago, transportation management software. You see this guy's logo on the back of every tractor trailer practically on the highway. It's for logistics and the trucking tracking. And, you know, the number one attribute was more revenue per truck. And so his clients tell him 26% more revenue per truck. It's a result of the software he wrote. See, it's not about your process of writing or delivering or your geniuses who are writing, but it's what did I get from what you did for me? That's the kind of thing, you know, the services saved me $370,000 in bottom line. Managed growth saved nearly $44,000 annually in administrative costs while managing growth of 25%. These are all kinds of things. I mean, I could talk all day long about the kinds of statements these companies get when they do the research, find out what the customer values, and now we talk about that and quantify the savings or What did I achieve? Why did I ask you to write software or whatever your platform is that you're giving me? What is it supposed to do for me? And does it?
Yeah, it's really aligning what that North Star metric is for the company with what the customer values, not just an internal metric. And you say that, and it just completely resonates. And I'm thinking about, we've run businesses, you know, now and in the past and thinking about that. And it was 100% internal focused. It was about us. So, I mean, we knew what we were trying to do, but it did not necessarily translate to the marketing side. We didn't map that to what customers really cared about and position it that way. So I think that there's really something here.
Yeah, I always tell businesses you're leaving money on the table for want of a few of these exercises because it just connects. And, you know, my book, Creating Competitive Advantage and Relevant Selling, both of them are loaded with real life case studies. They show kind of what the company was saying before, blah, blah, blah. And then after double blind market research, what did the marketplace want to hear about? What were those three operational things you must deliver? And then they would get their metrics together, start selling it. And I mean, I've got story after story of massive success. You know, one small company ended up buying his largest competitor and just rolled up the whole industry, all because he nailed this thing. He not only nailed it internally with metrics, but he put it on his website. And every month he updated with a graph, you know, on-time delivery, first-time performance. It was all graphed. So he had credibility. Wow. And his salespeople, and this is what I love, the salespeople could use the website as their sales tool. You don't need anything more. Go in and show a client, here's what we're doing. And here's, you know, here's where it goes right. Here's where it goes wrong and why. And one client said to us, my salesmen call me up screaming because we didn't update at the end of the month and they've got a client the first of the month because they're so dependent on it because they're so proud of the performance. And they know when they go in there, they're talking to the customer about what they care about because they invested in double blind market research.
That's really big. Do you have a memorable example of a company maybe sitting on a landmine in terms of their top-rated attributes and how you help them?
Yeah. So the one company that comes to mind, it's not software, but, you know, it doesn't matter. Same thing applies across the board. This was a company in Vancouver. They had a rather large piece of equipment that was manufactured in China. And the number one attribute, according to their research, was quality. We said, okay, how do you measure quality? Well, don't know. All right, what's your return and complaint rate? Don't know. We said, all right, you have a relatively small company with a very high ticket item, so it should be pretty easy. Measure it next month, maybe the month after, and then call us. So they did. They had 63 sales the first month and 54 head issues.
Wow.
63 sales at 54 head issues. They had no clue. So and the same thing happened the second month. So that with a little bit of investigation, they looked, the thing was manufactured in China. So they went over to China, the manufacturing plant, all kind of manufacturing defects. And it was their fault because they had the equipment drop shipped to the customer, not to them to inspect and then deliver. So now they fix the manufacturing defects, had it shipped to them. But the other big surprise, we said, well, how are you handling these complaints in customer service? He says, I don't know. So we said, get some of the emails the customer sent in. So he sent them to us, and he was red in the face, and he couldn't believe it. He was horrified because the emails to customer service and replies went something like this. Yes, we got your complaint. We're working on it. Okay, it's been 2 weeks. I haven't heard from you. Yeah, we're working on it. We'll get back to you. Or they would drop the ball. Their customer service people were doing the company in. Slight exaggeration, but not by much, because it was bad enough the product was bad, but then they weren't closing the loop on fixing it or addressing it. And that company was sitting on a landmine. They did this process with us in the nick of time, got the research. We asked them the right questions to uncover the landmine, and they were able to turn it around, cleaned out the customer service department, got new people who were more conscientious, fixed the problems in China, and they went on to grow. But there are so many things we don't know. The other example is sometimes about we don't know, we don't measure things, or we don't know what's being measured. We had one client in the UK, order accuracy was number one. He sells to wholesalers and retailers, and we put it up on the board, ta-da, here's your findings, order accuracy is number two, do you measure it? And the CEO jumps up, yay, we measure that. And his COO leans in and says, boss, we haven't measured that in 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And it was also a landmine. It was really low. Where do you think it was in the next 6 months? It was through the roof. All eyes were on that part of the operation.
Yep.
So there are so many things that we take for granted internally. And when we do something really well, we let our customers take it for granted. You know, if we're doing something spectacular for them, we're bending over backwards, we're saving them time and money, and we neglect to tell them how we save them time and money, then we're leaving our very own value proposition on the table with the money we've left behind.
Yeah, that's big.
Yeah,
just you know, what is measured gets managed. And when we're not even measuring it, how do we know? But the other step is really understanding even, you know, what to measure and making sure that aligns with what our customers are looking for.
Yeah, so and are important. We measuring the right things? Because, you know, people say, oh, this is overwhelming. I don't want to measure all that stuff. You don't have to measure all that stuff. When you know the three or four things that are must-have for your marketplace, you know, measure those and then tout them. You see this e-discovery company that sold software to law firms. They had a couple of really good ones that I liked, and they were really good. They were actually one of the handful of companies who guessed the top buying criteria. And we find that when they do guess it, we say, okay, good, you got the right ones. What are you doing about it? Are you saying it? And the question is no. You know, we knew those were the important things, but we didn't have a metric for it, and we weren't saying it. So like this one, we are the only company, this was a software company, we're the only company in their space that publishes our accuracy rate. It was 99.7% or better for all of the last 2 years. We averaged 46 quality control checks per project. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that people want to hear when you're doing, you know, what are the results? We're one of only five such companies that are ISO 27001 audited and the first to be certified. So those are the kinds of things that people take for granted. You know, it's interesting. I've also coached a few executives on how to do their personal advantages, their personal positioning. And so many of us individually have things that are terrific about our background and what we've done, but we forget about them and we don't put them out there. And so it's the same thing with companies. They can't see the forest through the trees. We've got all this good stuff. We're just not talking about it. Yeah, here was one. It's again the same software company. Their workflows can increase review speed by up to 400%. I mean, that's what their software did. It was staggering what this company did. And they took off like bandits when we got done. And then they ultimately got sold because they were so powerful. But they just started focusing. They did the research. They said, we know those things are right. We just didn't do anything about them. And then they did. It's fabulous.
So how do they know what the right things are? How do they know what the customers really care about? How does the research work? How do they get that?
So we do for our clients double-blind market research, and it can be expensive for a smaller startup. So I'm going to give you both ways. The double blind is telephone survey. It's not automated or anything. It's a real person calling. But the double blind, even the interviewer who's calling the customer as the respondent doesn't know who's commissioned the research. They just have a programmed set of questions. You know, do you buy such and such kind of software? How often? You know, what do you use it for? Blah, blah, blah. And then we design the market research questionnaire. It goes to the call center. They make the calls. We usually go for 140 interviews, 70 customers, and 70 prospects. That way, you can see the difference. And I have a really good slide example I've used in the past of an IT infrastructure company where I took four buying attributes, documentation being one of them. And the documentation was really important to prospects, but existing customers didn't care. And the same with accuracy of documentation. So those kinds of things, prospects and customers may value different things. So you can't use the same sales pitch for everybody. That changes about 75% of the time. So, you asked me about how to do the research. So as I said,
Do we do the research?
Yeah.
Two different ways. One is you guys do it. It could be expensive. And then
my book, The Relevant Selling, on chapter 9, there's some inexpensive ways. So if you can't afford to do it outside, hire a firm, go to your local university. You may find some market research students who will do it for free or a stipend. There are pros and cons to that, of course, but at least it's an alternative that you can at least have them do some attribute testing about your product or service and get a sense of what's valued. You can do it yourself have somebody else put it out there with SurveyMonkey, but it's better if you remain anonymous, because being anonymous, which is why we like the double blind, removes the bias. If they know it's you, they're always going to say, well, price is most important. Oh, and let's talk about price. When we first started doing this and we do 20 attributes, we used to test price in there. Now it's double blind. Nobody knows who's asking. You're not in the middle of negotiation. Where do you think price falls? Bottom 10. It's never in the top.
Yep.
So we stopped testing it that way. And now we'll say, what's most important to you when you buy payment software, a payment platform software? And, you know, whatever it is, we're asking about 40% of the time, they'll say price, not 80 or 90%, 40%. Then we'll say on a 1 to 10 scale, how important are these other buying attributes? After the attribute ranking, rating, we then say what else is important. They now have a chance to say price again, and now only 10% say price. So I told that story to a sales force, and the guys were arguing with me, like, oh, you don't know our business. It's all about price. So I said, look, it was 40% at the front end. Then we did attribute testing, and then it was 10%. He goes, yeah, of course it went to 10% because you had them thinking about all those other things. Thank you, genius. That's the point. Most companies don't.
Isn't
have
it? Them. Yes.
They don't have them thinking about the other things. And everybody says, well, we're a commodity. You let yourselves be a commodity. You paint yourself into a commodity corner when you don't differentiate yourself. And you can. When we do our in-house workshop with companies, we usually have anywhere from 10 to 16 employees. At the end of the day, we have, no kidding, brainstormed about 50 potential differentiators. Now, they're not all going to make it. Some of them are going to hit the cutting room floor because the company never will get the metric for it or have it, or they're just not relevant. So, you know, then we weeded out which are the ones that matter and what's the low-hanging fruit? What did you say in this workshop today that you're not saying and you could be saying tomorrow? So those are the kinds of things. But yeah, people, small companies can do it themselves. But get somebody to do it for you. You know, when I say do it yourself, you don't have to hire like we do. You know, the double blind market research, like I said, it's pricey. But you get all kinds of cross tabs and information about competition.
So if a company is relatively early in the process and maybe they got product market fit, they've started to get some traction and really looking to scale up, but maybe don't have 100 companies that they can go survey yet. How do they get the information?
They don't have to be their own customers. They can be prospects. It can be anybody who buys what you're selling. So, you know, very often we'll ask our clients, how extensive is your customer list? And they go, you know, it's not really very big. It's maybe it's 100. We go, well, 100 is not good enough because we get a 10% response rate. So we'll either buy a list or you'll tell us how many prospects, how many organizations out there could buy what you sell. Oh, thousands. Okay, now we can buy a list. Because it doesn't matter. It's whoever's making the buying decision. We also ask, what are the title or titles, you know, of the people? Is it the IT manager? Is it the CFO? Is it the CEO? Who's making the buying decision for what you're selling? And we will ask in our surveys, are you the decision maker or the influencer? And that's important too, because when you're going to sell, who are you meeting with first? Are you trying to sell an influencer or the decision maker? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have different values. And so you want to make sure you hit them both.
Yeah. What types of questions should we be asking in doing that research to get the right answers, to really kind of get below the surface answers of, you know, how do they really evaluate the solution?
It's not so much about what kinds of questions, it's what kind of attributes can you test. In other words, like I said, on a 1 to 10 scale, how important is being on time, responsiveness, regulatory features, documentation, ability to fix something, you know, turnaround time, first time response. So how important are each of those on a 1 to 10 scale? That's for starters. That's an easy way to do it. But we ask a number of questions, and it depends on the industry. It depends on the company. You know, how often do you buy this product or service? When was the last time you bought it? Who did you buy from? Who would you not buy from again, and why? So there's a number of questions when you design. There's kind of an art and a science to designing double-blind market research questionnaires. But simplistically, for small companies, you can just ask. You can come up with a list of attributes and say, you know, rank them for me. What do you absolutely positively have to have?
That makes sense.
It's better than not asking. You know, it's better than being completely internally focused, like Peter Drucker says, 90% of information. So we make all our decisions, we're all internally focused. We get in our meeting room, we say, yeah, Jim, that's a good idea, we'll do that. Or we make decisions anecdotally. Well, the last customer just said to me, well, that's one customer. And we've done that. Right. We tested information that the sales team said the customer wants, only to find out it didn't rank very high. It did with one or two customers, but not good enough to change a whole operation because of it. And that anecdotal decision making can be very risky.
It happens a lot. One customer, you get a little bit of feedback and make big decisions, big changes based on, you know, very small amount of information. And you hope it's right. And probably sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's the sample size is too small to make a big decision with.
Yes. And, you know, the other thing is when you figure out what those three or four things are, the customer values, it simplifies, in my view, the whole planning process. I'm not one for these big ornate strategic planning documents and sessions. I said, you know, one of the things I teach when I talk to business owners is if you find out three or four things, your strategic plan's right in front of you. Three things operationally, you know, whether it's on-time delivery, first-time fix, response time, let's say those are the top three things. That's your strategic plan. You now have three things you have to make sure you operationally deliver, and you hold people accountable and you talk about it. It makes life simple once you know the top three things. And I say,
I love the simplicity. Simplicity wins. Yeah. What are maybe some surprising things that you found in your research where, you know, customers value certain attributes that companies had no clue or didn't prioritize at all?
We find that often. Some of the things that the company said come in 1, 2, or 3, the customer said it came in dead last, or vice versa. We've had clients say to us, oh my God, I'm glad we did that. We were spending money on that and they don't care. You know, it can be something as simple as post-sale support. You know, the salespeople in a company will always rank that high. Oh, it's really important, you know, what we do in sales. And then the customer's like, yeah, I can take it or leave it, you know. So, you know, sometimes we have to say, don't shoot the messenger. This is what is, and I'm just making that one up. That's as an example. But, you know, very often, you know, one of the things we did early on was a web developing company long ago, one of our first clients, and I'll never forget this one. They were touting, we say, you know, most of the company doesn't know what the three things are. In this case, they have agreement. The employees don't have agreement on the top three. So this company had agreement. They thought it was the size of their company, how they've grown, their Fortune 500 list, and the awards they won. Those were the three things they said were top. So when we did the research, out of the 20 things we tested, those three things, they came in 18, 19, and 20. Dead last. Wow. The three things they were proud of. But so that's why I say it's not what you think you're good at. It's not what you're proud of. It's what do you value in the buying decision? And then we help them find that out. And they took off. They're now franchised all over the country. But, you know, it was amazing. They just weren't dealing with the right things they needed to deliver.
That's big for alignment and especially getting leads and prospects in. But what about existing customers? So, you know, a lot of companies will focus really heavily on Net Promoter Score. I mean, it's the gold standard. But is that really as valuable as they think it is?
Don't get me started on Net Promoter Score, because I am not a fan. And I just got in trouble at an association I presented to. Little did I know a guy in the audience does the Net Promoter Score for the whole association. But I don't like them because Net Promoter Score is biased by nature, because you're only surveying your existing customers and you're only, you know, it's a report card. There's a lot of bias in Net Promoter Score. And also our research shows, we actually, because we got on the phone with this guy and we pulled up some of our research where we did test an attribute of how important is it that people in your field or people were referred to you. And our answer is nobody cares what other people think. Not really. Not really. You know, the Net Promoter Score is something to brag about, but it doesn't tell me anything about buying criteria or how well you'll do with me. That tells me how well you did with the last 50 people. So I have a blog. Your listeners, if they want, they can go to my website and find the blog on Net Promoter Score if they want to argue with me on that one. Okay, I did this again, sidetracked on Net Promoter Score. And you asked me what?
It's what it was about, was Net Promoter Score. And we'll make sure and link that in the show notes so people can read that. But if Net Promoter Score is not the right thing, what are maybe some alternative metrics that we should be tracking to gauge true performance in the eyes of our customers?
Yeah. So in your industry, what's the word? I forget what they call it. When you install it and it works right away, the install time. Putting the platform, what's the word? I forget what it's called.
Like implementation time or activation.
Implementation works the first time. Implementation doesn't involve 90 people. Like, we could do our implementation in 48 hours with two of your resources, all things like that. And I'm making that up because I don't know. Every company's different. Every platform that's being sold is different. You know, it depends, but you got to find out what the client values most. And it's a lot of companies want to talk about their people.
So how does a company effectively communicate that and really talk about competitive advantage to their prospects and customers without coming across as, say, like boastful or inauthentic?
All right. So, you know, it's funny, when I did a lot of speaking in Canada, the Canadian said to me, we don't like to be boastful. And I said, get over it.
Yeah.
If you've got really good metrics,
like that.
If you've got really good metrics, you need to tell the customer, look, we're proud of our operational excellence. Let me show you why we're proud. You can do it in a humble enough way, but it should be absolutely positively. These metrics should be updated. It should be on your website above the fold on the homepage. If you look at my website, smartadvantage.com, you'll see three metric boxes of the results of our clients. And that's what these guys should be doing. You know, what is the implementation? You know, 91% were on budget, on time, whatever they are, above the fold. And we go look at people's websites. In fact, every time I do a CEO group, I'm now, upon request, pulling their websites and ripping them to shreds, because they have people turn over their web development to some web guy and who's got a creative assistant, and you got all these gorgeous pictures, but I have no idea what you're selling above the fold. I've got these scrolling pretty pictures of buildings or roadways or trucks. What do you sell? It's not only what do you sell isn't clear above the fold, but what are your metrics proving you do it well? And if you do that on your website, you don't have to worry about bragging. Remember, people come to websites, they're looking for somebody to write, do their software, and they're scrolling through websites. How long do you think they stay? Under 10 seconds.
Right, that's quick.
If you have a value proposition with metrics, they'll stay over a minute and then click through. But if you want click-throughs, you got to have the hook in right away on your website. It should be in every, ask me where should you put this? It should be in every proposal. It should be on your business cards. I mean, that's a little hard because we like them to stay updated. It should be broadcast in all your social media. It should be on your LinkedIn page. It should be everywhere that customers or prospects see or hear anything about you.
That makes a lot of sense. And it keeps that message the same. It's uniform across every channel. So you're talking about the same things that your customers and prospects care about all the time.
Yes. And what I started to say before, when we ask companies to vote on what do you think the top attributes are, and we give it to a whole bunch of people, say 16 people, all different titles, guess what? They all have different answers. So my argument there is if internally you don't know what's important to your customer and what your competitive advantage is, how does the external marketplace know? Because depending on who you talk to, they're getting a different story. So now it's all fuzzy. Now you're not anything special and give me the best price.
So good. Yeah, and that's really just goes back to the commodity conversation. You will be a commodity if there's nothing else to differentiate on.
Yes.
If there's no competitive advantage, if they all look the same, then it does come down to price.
Exactly right. Yeah. And people are, like I said, I ask business owners, how often do you review competitive advantage? And they say never. It's like, this is the single most important thing you can do. In fact, I got hooked on this reading J. Conrad Levinson's book. He was an old marketing guru, wrote about 100.
Sure, Guerrilla Marketing.
Yeah. That was the book, Guerrilla Marketing. In there, he said, I believe companies should focus solely upon competitive advantage and nothing else, for it's the wisest business investment a company can make. I read that, I got hooked. And I started asking every business person I met, what's your competitive advantage? And I got, exceed expectations. I'm going, please. our people are our competitive advantage. I said, you and every other company out there. So I started hearing these garbage answers. And I said, then I started to devise this process. And I tested it on a few guinea pig companies I was working with. And then I'm not sure if I told you the JTEC story. That's a great story. The restaurant pager you get when you go in and they say your table will be this thing will light up. That was an early client of mine. It's in the first chapter. The story's in the first chapter of my book. So these guys owned a very trendy restaurant in Jensen Beach, Florida. It was hot spot. It was packed. But people would leave because they didn't want to wait an hour for a table. And they always regarded this as these dollar signs walking back to the parking lot because they wouldn't wait. So lucky for them, they were techno geeks and they cobbled together the very first restaurant pager. It was terrific. Literally made it in the garage, brought it to the restaurant. It was success. If you remember the first time somebody gave you one of those, it's like, oh, this is cool. I know I'm properly in the queue. I'll stay.
Yeah.
People loved them. Right. So, but they had an unintended consequence. The unintended consequence was people came up to them and said, I have a restaurant. Where'd you buy these? I want these for my car dealership. Where'd you buy these? And these guys said, we didn't buy them. We just made them for us. If I give you an order, will you make some for me? Well, this was coming at them fast and furious. They got a big, they got a capital investor, give them some money. They built a manufacturing plant in Boca Raton, Florida, and they started making these things like crazy. So they're making these things and the restaurant chains discover it. Now the orders aren't 50 or 100. They're 1,000, 2,000. Get another capital investor and they now have two investment groups in here. And this manufacturing plant is expanding. Forget the restaurant. We're now in the manufacturing business. So they're doing great with this JTEC pager. And one day I go in, I sit down with the CEO and he's not too happy. I said, Jeff, what's the matter? He says, I just heard that Motorola wants to compete with us. If you remember the beepers we all used to wear before we all had phones, really dates me. Yeah. You know, I say this to a young guy. I had a young guy in a group say, I remember, I saw it on the History Channel. Shut up, wise guy.
That's great.
But anyway, we used to wear beepers before we had phones, and Motorola fashioned themselves as the beeper people, and they wanted to get in this restaurant pager business. So the CEO says, I don't know, this is going to be bad for us. So I said, well, bring your team together, give them to me in the conference room, and I'm just devising this let's find a competitive advantage process. So we do it. We work all day. We get flip, not all day, a couple hours. We got flip chart paper all over, great statements they're coming up with. And there was one. I said, this is so good and so easy. You don't even have to do anything. It's low-hanging fruit. You make sure every restaurant using your pager hears this. Every restaurant who is not yet using a pager hear this, and you make sure Motorola hears this. You make sure that pager department hears this. One simple competitive advantage statement, it was this. Of the 50 major restaurant chains using pagers in North America, 100% of them use JTEC pagers.
Oh, so good. That's gold.
It's gold. I mean, it was gold.
Yes.
So what do you think we told the marketplace? So Motorola, 800-pound gorilla, deep pockets, they do a little research. They go to you, the restaurant owner, and says, yeah, but, you know, we're Motorola. You'll switch to us. And you say, no, my servers, my customers love this. I'm not switching. Then Motorola goes to the guys, the restaurant owners who don't have pagers yet. Well, when you start getting pagers, you'll go to Motorola. He says, no, if it's good enough for the big boys, the big chains, it's good enough for me. I'm going with JTEC. Motorola never entered the market. And JTEC went on to have two massive liquidity events for those two investor groups and sold to a gigantic point of sale company for multiples they never dreamed possible. All we did was find one simple differentiator that kept them sane. So, you know, that's a simple one, too, that your listeners can use. Who's on your client list? It doesn't have to be 100. It can be three of the largest banks in our community use our platform. Three of the largest retailers use our platform. Whatever it is, use it to build confidence and reduce risk.
It's really, really good. How often should we be reviewing our competitive advantage? What type of cycle should we be looking that at? And how do we keep it, you know, compelling and relevant over time?
So my favorite is to have a website page that shows. So the one example I have is one company, they do rolling metal for machines, and first time performance and on time delivery were the top two. He has them on his home page above the fold. You click on it and you get graphs. Every month he updates the performance every month. And that's how you keep it alive. And then the only thing you need to update, and I say maybe once a year, or depending on the industry, you can maybe go 2 years, is to redo the research and make sure the top three or four things you're focused on are still the top two or three things. Depends on changing industry, trends in the industry, competition. So that might change things. But, you know, you get three or four things that the customer tells you absolutely positively got to have, and you're focused on it and you're putting your metrics up. You're gold. We've seen the companies that have done that that are our clients. They have gone on to roll up their industry, sell for big multiples, massively successful. And it's so simple. It's really not hard. So, you know, an easy way, people, the small startups, they don't have to hire me, Smart Advantage. They can read my book because the book is loaded with examples, loaded with case studies. At the end of each chapter, there is questions that you can ask yourself to go through the exercises. And really, you know, I've had CEOs say it's my Bible. I keep it on my desk. I've yellow highlighted every page. So it's easy. That book is what I call a one airplane ride read because it's easy read.
Outstanding. And one of the things that you mentioned also was team members' prior experiences to identify competitive advantages. So it could be where they came from or, you know, other places in the market. Can you elaborate on that idea maybe an example?
I'll give you an example in another industry. So research came back for one company. I think they were commercial air conditioners, and the experience of the technicians was top. And so they said, well, our technicians, most of them have been with us an average of 7 years. I'm making this up. So we said, it's not how long they've been with you. It's how long have they been putting this equipment on the roofs of buildings. So HR went out and asked each of them, where did you work before here? How many installs did you do? And they started calculating them. Then they had a number that said the average number of commercial air conditioners that were installed by our technicians was, 25 or 50. I don't remember what the numbers are. But, that's how you can talk about history. It's not just what you've done in this company that you're just starting. It's what do the people, the team that you're bringing in, what do they bring to the company that builds confidence and reduces risk?
Yeah. So every company has assets within the organization. They have competitive advantage. It's really figuring out what those are and surfacing what to talk about, and what then mapping that to what their customers and their prospects really care about, and aligning those two.
Yeah, and like I said, it makes your planning easy. You just have a few things operationally you got to nail. You got to nail it so you can talk about it, brag about it.
Outstanding. Well, where can we learn more about you online? Yes. And get a copy of your book, of course.
So Smart Advantage, S-M-A-R-T, smartadvantage.com. And I do some keynote speaking that can be found at Janie Smith, J-A-Y-N-I-E, smith.com. And there's a whole bunch of information there, and there's links to many, many blogs, including that MPS one that people can take it or leave it, but that's our view, and it's all spelled out in there, all the whys. Janie Smith or jsmith@smartadvantage.com is my email, jsmith@smartadvantage.com.
Excellent. We'll make sure and link all of that in the show notes, and of course, the blog article, and we'll link your book as well.
Okay.
Everybody should pick up a copy of that because it's a short book. It's a very easy read, but it is absolute gold.
Yeah.
So many good things in there. And just the examples are super helpful because it just lays out, how to position that and how to phrase it. And it's just so much clarity in so little time.
Yeah. I've had people say to me, your book is like the V8 moment, a thump on the head. I should have known this.
That's exactly what it is. It's like, why didn't I think of that? And you read it and you go, that makes so much sense. It's so obvious. It's so easy. How did I miss that all this time?
Yeah, it's good. We have a lot of fun doing it.
Well, thank you for being on the show. This has been super helpful.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again, Janie, for coming on the show and sharing your insights and lots of examples. Good stuff. Everyone should grab a copy of Janie's book. I did, and I sent it to several friends as well, and it is absolute fire. So it really makes you rethink your competitive advantage and how you're presenting that in the marketplace. And you know what? If you get my book along with it, send me a note and I will send you some free bonus audios, videos, and some more stuff as a thank you as well. You can learn more about Janie at smartadvantage.com. As always, all links, highlights, resources, the links to the books, and full show notes are available at sasfuel.com. And be sure to check us out on YouTube as well. Full episodes, video shorts, training, outtakes, all sorts of things. Maybe even the woodpecker in the background we just heard. Thought leaders share. Send a link to this episode to a friend who wants to stand out in their market. They'll think that you've got the inside track on cool info and be grateful to you as well. I know I always am when somebody sends me something like that. And everyone who shares this week gets a Blue Ocean Navigator. It's a strategic device that guides you through uncharted market territories, helping you carve out that niche that competitors haven't even dreamed of, securing your place as a market innovator. No commoditization for you. Join us next Tuesday, where our founder is Jason Radisson, CEO of Movo. He is revolutionizing management in the gig economy and international payments. So we'll talk about the secrets to skyrocketing employee engagement and operational efficiency through AI and mobile technology. Very cool stuff. Jason's been part of several SaaS unicorns that you would know, 99 Taxis being one and Uber being another. And next week on our SaaS Fuel Expert Series, we have Barrett King. He was an early employee at HubSpot, did some amazing things there, and is now a top solutions partner for HubSpot. He specializes in strategic partnerships, boosting customer engagement and retention, all while delivering exceptional experiences. I'll see you next time, and as always, enjoy the journey.
Thanks for listening to SaaS Fuel. full show notes for each episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, quotes, and any resources mentioned, are available at sasfuel.com. Be sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the content and getting value from these episodes, please leave us a rating and review at ratethispodcast.com/sasfuel. We'll be sure to read these out on future episodes. Let's go.